Okay, we have board time Wednesday, 29 October at 1:30.
One of the first things we have up here is minutes. Catching up with the approval of our minutes. October 15th and October 22nd.
I would make a motion we pass the minutes of the 15th and the 22nd unless there's amendments.
Oh, okay, thanks. Let me just give you a minute here. Simple enough. I second that motion.
We're moving and seconded to accept the minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, and they already signed?
Okay.
Okay, moving on to 1.2. Commissioners, you might remember that last week we talked about the Lower Columbia Fish Recovery Board and their request to join us for payroll and benefits. And we had a rather vigorous discussion about that. And Francine and Kathy were asked to put together a list of other organizations that might follow suit if we were to give that privilege to this group, and so they're prepared to report on that.
Right, and then the we had two issues: allow them on our benefits at all, and then second, if we did allow them on our benefits, was would we allow them in the self-funded health insurance plans? Mm-hmm. So you have a list here of the other public agencies that we have in Clark County. It may not be 100% complete, but it's pretty close. We provide treasury functions for these agencies, or we provide some type of funding either directly or through one of our departments and the work that we do with them.
But none of them we provide health coverage.
Well, they are, if we do provide health coverage, they're on the back side, Commissioner, or you can easily reference this chart to be
medical. The bottom list here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So some of the larger ones, you know, the cities, the schools, they have not approached us in the past. Some of the other ones on the list over the years, and Kathy's been here 12 years, some of them have approached us in the past. So any of these others are possible.
They have approached us in the past. Mm-hmm. What did we say? What was their response? I mean, it must have been no because they're not on the list, but...
It's no, or we showed them what our plans were, what the costs were, and discussed other options with them, and they self-elected to go in a different direction. So that also
was there reasoning behind that? That was what, but why?
Either...
I mean, why would...
Why did we say no? Mm-hmm. Basically, just not looking to bring on any additional work, especially from a larger organization like Port of Vancouver. You know, that would be bringing on a larger pool of employees and looking at our staffing and whether we could, meet those needs.
Well, there's that, and there's also the complexity of being a multi-employer benefit plan, which has a whole different connotation. Like a health and welfare plan would be set up and you have different arrangements. It wasn't our intention to be a provider of benefits for our region. It was really to be a provider of benefits for our county staff. So it becomes a whole different with contracts with the providers, with our consultant, and how we do business would be very different if we became a multi.
Yeah, but I assume that if it costs us extra administration cost to bring them on, that we pass that cost on to them.
We have not been consistent in that. So some of them we do pass on some cost to because they're full service, like Cressa and RTC. They're in everything we do, so they get the indirects like another department would.
Okay, so we do account for it with indirects.
There
is a counter.
For some of the
agencies. For some of them. Some of the smaller ones we don't charge at all.
Southwest Behavioral Health, when we brought them on, we did set up a charge of $2,000 a month. So it's a flat fee.
Has the auditor ever looked at these to make sure that we're accounting properly?
We've had several discussions with them.
And they're good with it the way it is now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we haven't heard otherwise.
So this back page here is the one that you provide for currently.
Yes.
But, so like Southwest Clean Air, law library. Well, she law library would have indirects. Cemetery district, they're not paying for any of our services.
So all the ones on this side of the paper, cemeteries, libraries, fairgrounds.
No, just
only the ones that are indicated. They say
on the bottom.
Yeah, just the ones on the bottom.
I don't
on
see any other nonprofits on the potentials list. There are lots of nonprofits.
That's a different, and Chris could probably speak to that better than us. Nonprofits are, you know, we can set up interagency agreements with other governmental agencies, which is why we have the arrangement with agencies. Nonprofits would be.
Oh, the Fish Recovery Board is not a nonprofit?
No, it's a multi-county. It's actually an arm of the state.
It's an instrumentality of the state created to deal with fish issues. And I think there are, what, five or six regions?
Right. So
something like that.
Five counties in this
region. They all belong
to
the lower
county. It was actually created by Clark County, I think, in the beginning.
And the RCW also does not allow a public entity to bring on a nonprofit into a self-insured plan.
Mm-hmm. So now that you have this significant list here, is there a policy guideline or some recommendation that would help us help you to be able to say yes or no in the future that you'd recommend?
Not at this point. If you're asking for our recommendation, it was the board's recommendation. When we put the self-funding was to grandfather those that were already in and not allow anyone new to join. And that included participation by the PA's office, the treasurer, and the auditor in that recommendation. So that was our recommendation from the board to minimize our risk and exposure and
so
keep
they
it manageable.
Were involved in making that recommendation initially. Have they been asked at this point to consider this new policy that would let open the door further?
Informally, we did not have a board meeting, so it was an informal polling.
Survey.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what was the?
Well, the majority leaned toward letting the Fish Recovery Board on our benefits, and mainly I was speaking to just the Fish Recovery Board, not opening it up any more than that.
Okay, so not necessarily creating a policy, because I don't want to make extra work on it. But just simply just keep it simple. You got one request, and it makes sense to them, and so they're suggesting that we open the door for them.
Yeah. Plus, we have a commissioner on their board, and we have a financial linkage with them.
Absolutely, we do.
Because of the settlement and the fact that they're going to do work, and we'd like to be able to.
And we did some additional surveying in terms of what other agencies might be doing in terms of, from a policy standpoint, whether they would let an outside agency participate or not. We didn't get any feedback locally or even nationally. We put a question out through one of our national links. But I then talked to Clackamas County this morning, and their policy is quite simple. If a board member sits on an agency's board, then they would allow that agency to participate.
Okay. And I don't know that that's what we would recommend. I wouldn't recommend that, given the size of some of these other groups.
In other words,
this is off.
We're not opening a door that is going to make it complicated. We're going to get other requests in, and then we're going to wonder, how do we say no to those? It's not that. That would be overstating the problem. So that looks like it's simple, and everybody is, there's no red flags. Everybody's saying, sure, this is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Now
I'm gonna comment?
Let me ask a question. Under these agreements that you signed, do you have a 30-day, 60-day, 90-day cancellation clause in case something goes south?
We do.
Have the opportunity.
Okay.
We'll have to amend those agreements and take them to each of the boards who are parties to that agreement.
And this particular one, would we also pass on whatever administration costs are to them, too?
Yeah, we talked to the auditor's office.
$600 a month?
$600 a month is the charge for
I'm good.
Services.
Sounds good to me. Good. Okay. I think we have
I'll make the motion that we include that.
Allow them to members of the party.
Yes, as proposed.
Yeah, they got to pay the cover. Join
the party. They're paying everything themselves. No, they're bringing their own booze. They
pay their own food. Yeah. I didn't say
that. Is that a second?
I second it.
Okay.
We'll move to second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, we'll bring back the formal change to the interlocal agreement.
Thank
to
you.
The board.
Okay.
And I'd like
thank
to
you for
go in there. We address them individually as to our connection with them. I think we're probably extended to the extent that we are. We don't anticipate any more, but I think the direct connection that we have,
we you know, we'd probably talk to one or two agencies a year, honestly. So
it's
not that
rare. You'd bring that back to the board anyway.
If they are really serious about wanting to come forward, which Lower Fish Recovery Board was, most of them haven't been.
I assume we certainly give our blessing for that to happen, but there's still a process that needs to follow because the interlocal agreement has to be approved by the other parties in that agreement.
All
right?
The other parties.
Okay, so we understand that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good work.
Thank you, ladies.
Did you get my other sheet? Did you pick up that other
sheet? Can I skip something? You can have it.
Okay, next item on the agenda is 1.3 budget hearings. We typically, in December, the week we approve the budget, we have three hearings, one on Monday for our elected officials, an evening hearing on Tuesday for the public, and a morning hearing on Wednesday for the public. Commissioner Milke, I understand that you don't believe the Wednesday hearing is necessary.
I believe that we could do it during a Tuesday meeting. And that would open it to the public if there's any questions.
Okay, and so
we normally don't have really questions. I mean, it's somewhat in depth. The only people that would come up there would be those people that think that their budget is being cut, but that was already inside the county. They would have already spoke up.
Right. You're referring to the outside groups like 4-H and things of that sort.
Because
when we were in the throes of the recession, we were looking at cutting programs like that, and we had a procession of people who would come up and would say, please don't cut our program.
Yeah.
And then we had folks complaining about vacation time and benefits and all this other.
We had a whole bunch that we didn't feel was directly benefit the Clark County citizens as a whole that we separated from, and here's our list. So those were the chambers, all those organizations. We still have other grants that we have out there, the historical grants that we still provide. I just can't imagine anybody else is connected from us that we should be funding with county money.
So then a question for the board, as a board, is do you believe two hearings is sufficient, or do you want to have a third hearing on Wednesday? And so I would ask Commissioner Barnes and Commissioner Madore for their thoughts on that.
What this is, it's a presentation of the budget that we had a preview of.
Right.
And it's great that we opened it up to the general public to see what we're doing. Our work groups are open, like today, that was open to the public.
Mm-hmm.
They're all open to the public. It's more of a formal opening to the public. Mm-hmm. How many times do you want to do that?
Yeah, and I would say if you're only going to have one hearing for the public, that it should be an evening hearing. To allow the working
more
people in the county to attend without having to take time off from employment.
So there is an evening hearing scheduled already?
The first
is this a normal BOCC meeting?
It's a budget hearing as part of the consent hearing, first Tuesday of the month of December, so it would be an evening hearing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we could throw it in with that one.
So,
well, you've been through this multiple times, so what do you recommend?
Little to none. I just can't imagine why any group would come up here and complain if we had cut them off anything that we were funding for their personal fund.
Okay, because you've got more experience on it than I do, so you're hasn't been a big long
run out of time. You know, we recognize some of those that we feel that we're connected to, we want to keep alive, the museum being one of them, Shalachie Prairie Railroad is another.
Yeah.
Those are connected to the county.
Yeah, and given the excellent process that the county went through preparing the budget, the fact that we're maintaining our fund balance at 52 days in a prudent manner, the fact that we're funding some, you know, a position for the prosecuting attorney, another one for the sheriff, we're funding some important items. I think it's a non-controversial budget.
So you're both in agreement that
that won't generate a great deal
fine.
Of...
Just Tuesday hearing.
We didn't get to vote. Just
well, I
you've been here for a while. You know.
Are you, I believe we're going to stick to the 3 minutes, or depending.
Oh yeah.
You're going to stick strictly to the 3 minutes.
Sure.
Time?
Okay.
I think we will be able to say we met our obligation for public involvement if we only have one.
Okay.
That's right.
I guess we have consensus.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good. Okay. Well, that's the. Thin agenda, exhausted.
So we got Chris here.
Yeah, Chris.
Yes, he must have something.
No, he's in my back pocket.
Oh, he's protecting you.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful back pocket.
Yeah, exactly. He's my contingency plan. So I'm going to turn it over to the board for commissioner reports.
Okay. I'm good.
You're good?
I'm easy.
Okay.
Well that's a mighty high opinion of yourself.
Well, I got about seven things I want to talk about today, but the most important one I want to talk about to bring up today is I think that the commissioners need to take another look at the elected official salaries. The treasurer, the auditor, the assessor, the sheriff, and the clerk. I understand Axel's done some checking in. He's found out that the commissioners can adjust those folks' wages at any time. It doesn't require, you know, to wait until the next agreement's up. But I do think that maybe I would have liked to have us wait for another week, David, Tom, for to have a chance to talk about it. But, you know, to get it over time, the election is, couldn't really do that. It would have been the day before. But
day of.
Yeah, they have. So I would suggest that we take a good hard look at those individuals again.
Yeah, where I was coming with that is that what we had on the agenda really didn't pertain to them.
Yes.
It pertained to your position, and that's where David pulled back from where he wanted to go.
Right.
And then we addressed our
concerns.
Our car reimbursement. And that's what we were focused on at that day.
Yeah.
They were caught up into it somewhat because of the effect that could be on them. I think it's something that's going to be addressed after next Tuesday, if need be. And we can do that one way or the other.
Right. Yeah, the resolution, I don't think we really took a good hard look at the resolution that the auditor read the way we should have looked at it. When he read that thing.
Well, it was presented right on the spot.
And yeah, I know.
Certainly
and I told him to read the thing so we'd everybody better understand it, but I still think that even after the election, Tom, that's fine, but I think we ought to take a look at them because I've looked at some of these numbers and I don't think it's fair again that somebody in their position is working somebody
to make it. You know where we've come from, and one of the things I brought up is that we were on track of getting $1,000 a year increases.
Yeah.
And long about 5 years ago or so, all of a sudden, that ended up being $2,000. And I don't know where it came from, but all of a sudden we're getting $2,000 a year increases. Technically, I thought we might have overpaid some of us, except most of us had our wages frozen. But I think it's something we can address. But one thing we need to recognize is that an elected official isn't necessarily a certificated person of expertise. You don't have to be an auditor to be an elected auditor or a treasurer to be an elected treasurer. The only one you have to be is a sheriff. Within 1 year, you have to come back and have a degree, whatever it's called, I believe that's right, isn't it, Chris?
I think that's true of all the other positions, and I do believe the sheriff has to be just like the prosecutor.
I think to get 1 year after that. So technically, it's like a legislator.
Yeah.
They're citizen legislators. They're just policy makers, and we make policy by the experts sharing with us their experience. That don't mean that we get the expert pay.
Right.
And so I think it's not a closed thing. I'm willing to look into it as we come back.
Okay.
and we can do that.
I really think those individuals, I think that they spend a lot of time and effort on behalf of the people. And like David mentioned, that the assessor saved $1 million just recently that we used to cover up some holes with. They've been using a three-headed office staff down there to do everybody's work, the three of them. So, I mean, they've done a lot of changes that have benefited
matters.
The taxpayers. So I think that I think it's warranted we take a better look at that situation. So the other one I got is Darwin Zimmerman. I don't know if he talked to you guys.
Mm-hmm. About
the
garden
out.
Oh, yes.
Okay, he said he needs some help, and he wants to know where the county's going to waive the permits and stuff, and he wants to make sure that the county is in favor of what they're trying to do with this fireplace and all the rest of the stuff, because he said he doesn't want to raise the $40 million and have the county say no.
Yeah.
So we went back, and I directed him back to Heath Henderson
me too.
And Bill Berzerke.
This is Mabry, though. This is a work site for work crews, for the correction.
Apparently, there's a whole bunch of acreage out behind there that we own.
But we want to build this garden and stuff there.
So that's all I know about it. So maybe it'd be a good idea to get a aerial view of what we're talking about and how it would be accessed, if it would have to be accessed through that area, or I don't know how they'd access it.
Yeah, here. Go ahead.
There's already access to the Mabry site, and I believe it's off of 502.
Right, that's through our facility.
Just to the south of the Padden, I believe.
Yep.
If I remember, I haven't been out there in a coon's age.
I was out there picking up signs out of the garbage.
But he's putting a finger on a whole lot of people. The one up at Riverview Bank, he's trying to convince them to put a huge chunk of money, and they would maybe name.
Yeah. Here's where I think it would be very helpful. The way that we can be most helpful would be to make sure that Bill Bjerke, Heath Henderson, whoever would be involved in that whole project management, make sure they're all on the same page, to make sure that we accommodate and facilitate and encourage them to go ahead and communicate.
So
that if there's something that we need to do to give the green light, because everybody's on the same page, and absolutely we ought to do so. Do you know if he's actually gotten together yet with Public Works?
It was only yesterday that I talked to him, and he's pretty much on the run. So I'd like to hear back from our staff and get an aerial view of what we're talking about.
Yeah. Certainly we don't want to make the process longer, difficult, and like that. We want to give them the green light, encourage them, and say, what do we need to do to help support you? Mm-hmm. And if there's any red flags that or any changes that our Public Works staff suggest that we do, that they somehow let us know what do we need to do to remove the obstacles and support that really good cause.
Yeah, I think we need to get the folks who actually operate the site involved. I don't believe Heath and Bill have anything to do with the site.
Sounds like it's
over in
district
court. Well, my fundamental question is, we're not, when the county remodeled the permit center, when we built the space for the PA in this building, when we did family court, when we did the child and children's justice center, the county always paid for its permits. And does the board support waiving permit fees for this? That would be the question.
That's what I wanted to know right up front, so that they could get somebody to go ahead and sponsor the permits.
I want to make sure that we don't access that park by going through the facilities.
Yeah.
I know of no other entrance to it.
And to build one would require a traffic study and significant investment.
So let's just find out what's involved.
Yeah.
I think it's incumbent upon the fellow asking to do it to give us a concept.
Okay.
Instead of just saying, here, I want this. Yeah. Have staff go do stuff. I think the judge needs to break a blank sheet of paper and show us what he contemplates. How to get to it, and all that.
And so he can link up with you, and you can help to pull together whatever staff's necessary to get some answers.
Yep.
Great. That sounds like a path forward.
Which one of you guys wants this? No, I'm just kidding.
An aerial view of what we have.
Yeah, we can do that.
And you're right. I think before we go ahead at all, we need to know how much land, how is it going to be accessed, how it's going to affect the people there.
Then we want every chapter in the book.
So you're going to bring definition to that.
Yeah.
Great.
So tell me
okay,
the Z that we're looking into it, and there are no promises yet.
The other one I got on my agenda, I had a conversation, and I think maybe the other two commissioners did too, about realigning the road at Salmon Creek to the proper Washington State University to get away from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've got some additional information on that. When Oliver met with you three, the impression might have been created that WSU was asking for this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's actually something the county asked the WSU to agree to, because we want that road out of the floodplain.
Yep.
And to do so, we need a bunch of right-of-way that WSU owns. And mm-hmm. so as part of the developer's agreement that we entered into decades ago, WSU agreed to dedicate right-of-way to that realigned road. I also got from Heath a copy of the capital facilities plan, and that road realignment is in the capital facilities plan.
Great.
So that emergency...
it's not necessary.
Yes, it is.
Oh, is it necessary?
So,
it okay.
So that's what's so strange. We were talking about it. It was done in 2008.
Well, that was an amendment to it. The original agreement was done 13 years previous to that.
It was already there.
Or 1999.
Yeah. So I'm really curious as to where we're going to put that on our regional plan. Well, because I think that we have other things with the higher priority.
We do. But like I just said, Commissioner, we have a six-year transportation improvement program we're going to brief the board on here in the next week or two.
I don't think that'd be in the six-year plan.
It's not, but it's in the 20-year plan.
Yes.
So the higher priority things are being accomplished.
Okay.
So realignment of Salmon Creek is farther out. And so therefore, we just like to get it on the arterial atlas so anybody buying land or taking real estate actions knows that we're going to move that road.
So my question back then is, why wasn't it on the arterial atlas in 2008?
I got a shoulder shrug on that. You know, Heath is in charge now, and he doesn't know why it was. And Steve Schulte's gone.
Green light.
So
anyway, I think we ought to use it if we can.
Yeah.
Yep.
So... I guess we have consensus, yes, green light, bless it.
Okay, thank you. That's excellent. Thank you, Commissioner Barnes, for bringing that up.
The other thing is that I was at a meeting in Portland, and they handed out and I give a copy of this to Jeff, he made a copy, but it's called Self-Sufficient Standards. And the University of Washington created this. And they now have adopted it in 37 states out of the 50. And it gives, this has to do with the state of Oregon here. And I had Lene request through an email to get the copy of all the counties in the state of Washington. It gives this information on what it takes to have a living for one person, two people, three people, what the wages are in all these counties. They are going to send that to you folks on the 20th of November. And it's something new that I didn't even realize was even in place, and neither did some of the other folks I talked to. But I'll have them make a copy of this program for you. And I think it's something that's really worthwhile.
So it's just sharing information?
Yeah, I think it's something that I never even knew was in existence. And it compares every county in the state of Oregon. It'll compare every county in the state of Washington the same way with the with the whole ball.
Always
wax.
Welcome so, information. So yeah, I welcome it.
Yeah.
Thank
so
you.
Anyway, I think that's.
So we had. I had something like this. I still have it on my desk.
Yeah.
It's about 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah.
From the U.S. Census Bureau.
Yeah.
And they did it county by county.
Yeah.
Also.
So the University of Washington has been doing this for all these different states, which is. Pretty darn good to have a university here putting it in process.
Right.
So you could look at any state in the country and find out how they compare to the state
of
Washington. So see the surface mining, where are we at on that?
Well, we got a hearing coming up.
The latest draft is going to Planning Commission first week in November, next week or the week after, and then to you guys just after that. You're probably talking about the letter we received from Mr. Martin. Had some back and forth with him. He's upset that we made some changes after we met with the mining interests, and I understand that. We were fairly close. I think we had one thing that we disagreed with as a staff with the Livingston folks after we met with them. But, you know, I emailed back and CC'd our staff group when I did to Mr. Martin when he wrote in the first time. And I said,
who's that?
Mr. Martin is one of the Friends of Livingston Mountain, I think, group up there. And there's some we meet with the McCulloughs as well and a couple other people.
So what are they trying to change? Are we trying to change the Livingston Mountain?
No. So what we did is the board's recommendation after that last work session, remember the Livingston Mountain folks were there. They had a few things they wanted us to change and look into. The board's direction was for us to sit down with them, get as close as we could to incorporating those changes, but then also meet with the mining interest because we need equity and fairness.
And the lobbyists.
Yeah, and that's not on the map. That's on the regulations and the enforcement.
The development standards. And most of the conversation has centered around two major components. The first issue is, should it be a conditional use permit or permit it outright? And then the second piece is the piece we added on monitoring and enforcement, which is, you know, to some degree controversial. How much monitoring and enforcement should we do?
I was under the impression that they were going to go back and trying to change the rules on Livingston Mountain quarries.
No, and I would,
so
you know...
I want to make it real clear of that. And the rest of the stuff was what we were going to do on any future.
Mr. Martin, to some degree, I read through what he emailed the board. And I haven't had a chance to follow back up with him since he sent his latest correspondence to the board. But he was upset because that week that I gave you guys an update, we had met with Livingston, the Friends of Livingston Mountain. We had come very close on an agreement. We agreed almost on everything with the draft, and that's what I told the board. But we still, that was like October 15th. So it was a pretty positive discussion I had with you all, and he was not happy about that because he felt like I was reporting out on the draft with the changes for the mining interest, but we hadn't yet met, or we had just met, but we hadn't yet incorporated those changes because we didn't meet as a staff. So he felt like I was telling you guys that the Livingston folks are totally happy with the current draft, which as a staff we know that they aren't, but we hadn't yet incorporated those changes. And in my, and I'll give my opinion, I thought the changes were not all that significant. I mean, I thought we really did a good job as a staff of looking at what Mr. Dentler and the rest of the mining interests said, and really putting back in there what was reasonable. So it'll be up to the Planning Commission and you all to decide, but we'll show you very clearly where there's disagreement, and you guys can make the decision. But I don't think that, I still believe we're probably not that far off. I mean, we've really squeeze this thing down as much as we can.
So when we have our legal counsel here, I'll bring it up. It's not likely we're going to change anything that existing quarries already have without getting into a big old legal battle. Is that correct?
Well, there are certain first of all, there's a Supreme Court case that says if it relates to your police power regulations, a good example is stormwater regulations. If it relates to those kind of environmental regulations, regardless of whether they're in business, you can make them subject to that. And the state's made that clear on a number of occasions, not just the Supreme Court, but I mean ecology. So there are some things you can't do. If you were to try and say, we're going to zone it residential and make them close up tomorrow, you couldn't do that. But so you have some authority to regulate them or to affect their businesses. I don't think that what's being proposed it affects current businesses as much as it does businesses to be located or expanded, mm-hmm. and what the conditions would be for those enterprises.
Okay, that was my concern, and that we didn't go there, that we looked at any expansions, but don't go changing what's already in place, and we already have those things, and that's the controversy we have it. But Yakult, well, we've been accused of the environmental violations, but yet we've been up there, the state's been up there, and they find no violation of environmental impacts. So I just want to make real sure that we don't go someplace that we end up with a big fight on the other side of the issue, because it seems strange to me that all the regulations are being blessed by Livingston Mountain?
To the only change that may become an issue for you is noise. The state has its own regulation. We have adopted, for example, hours of operation, and there are some enterprises that claim non-conforming rights, or what some people call grandfathered rights. One issue that may come up through this adoption process is the extent to which the board wants to continue grandfathering hours of operation, because it's a tough balance for, depending on where the neighbors are, it's a tough balance, issue to balance.
There's a balance. I think where I live, I have a balance. Where you live, you have a balance. And that is, once in a while, you hear the rock crusher. And that's the way it is at my house, too. I'm a long ways away, so.
Well, you're correct, though, Commissioner Milky. The intent of this new code is not to impact those existing conditional use permits. Those will still be in place. They'll still dictate how those quarries operate. I think from the Livingston Mountain folks' perspective, they're worried about those areas that may expand, and then, you know, what would control that expansion or possibly a new quarry. But, you know, I will communicate back with Mr. Martin this week, you know, and we've had good conversations, good relationships so far, and I understand it's, you know, there's some sticking points in there, but that's what happens when you try to write a code to walk the line between residents and mining.
Well, I think you're right. I think they're happy with the way the progress is going, and they agreed with us that everything that both parties could agree to was wiped off the map, and then the things that they couldn't, that would be the items that we would end up trying to come to an agreement on. And I think the two major ones is the dust and the in the wintertime, it doesn't make any difference not covering the trucks and some stuff like that. So I don't think it's anything really major, but I would just like to see the thing get taken care of and over and done with, so that they don't have people coming to the meetings and
plus Oliver and his staff have major tasks crazy to complete, and it'd be so nice to put this to bed before the end of the year.
So this ends up being, when it's all said and done, an adopted ordinance, or is it an adopted policy? Which is it?
This will take the form, it will take the form of a resolution to the extent we're amending our comprehensive plan, but to the extent we're changing our development regulations, it'll be an ordinance. They're separate documents. We don't, anything that impacts the comprehensive plan and our compliance with GMA is done in resolution format, because it doesn't appear in the code and it's kind of a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. Provisions in our code, provisions that wind up in our code, like development regulations, we do by ordinance. So the actual putting things on the map will be by resolution.
The map is all done.
And so that's done by resolution. The regulations they have to satisfy, that they have to meet, will be done by ordinance.
Okay. So I think you just said it's passing a resolution that updates an ordinance a policy.
No, the resolution updates the map. And if that's already been done, you've already said what properties are in.
It is.
Okay, that's already done. So the only thing left would be the ordinance, and that updates our code.
Okay. Then what I would suggest is that it's a single document, right? Mm-hmm. It's one ordinance. And all of that's been agreed upon, that all the parties are saying, yep, that's good, be all proposed. And if there be anything where party A is wanting something and party B is wanting something else, that we would just simply say, this wording is party A's preference, this wording is party B's preference, and you just present those two ready to go, so that we can choose or possibly blend between the two, so that we can very clearly get everything done and see what needs to be nailed down.
Okay. Well, let me make sure I understand, because actually I think we can do that, okay? We'll have to do it. It's going to make it, of course, longer, but what we can do is we'll take it section by section, so sections of the code, mm-hmm. maybe even paragraph by paragraph. But what we'll do is we'll do it in table form, and we'll have A and B, and the way ordinances are written, of course, as you know, is that Where we're changing, where we're not changing the language, it just stays the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're deleting language, that'll be put in double parentheses and strikeout, and where it's new language, we'll underline it. But we can do all that, and we'll do it by section, and as I say, to some extent, even by paragraph, mm-hmm. so that you'll always be able to see the two together, and then circle what you want or do however you want. We can fix that for you. I could probably do it on my iPad.
Yeah.
Send it, and then we can get it to you.
Yeah, and make that available to both parties or the citizens that are out there, the industries that are out there, as well as us, so everybody can see that, and they understand, each of them, where there's a difference, that we're going to have to decide either on full A or full B or some blend between the two on each of those.
Well, and just so everybody's clear, I know Mr. Martin was a little upset, but we were 100% clear coming out of the meeting with them. We are going next week to meet with the mining interests. There will be some changes. So I feel like the staff's been very upfront with this, and Gordy's posted Mr. Dentler's letter. He's posted the new code is posted, so we should take a look at it before we. I mean, I hear what you're saying and showing the changes.
Well, I'm just
good.
Responding.
But
it's
all out there.
I hope you have it out there in draft form.
Yeah, no, the new draft that's being proposed at the Planning Commission's out there. Mr. Dentler's letter's out there, and the original Planning Commission recommendations.
We just don't want to somehow stack the deck so it looks like this is what we're proposing, and we don't really pay attention to the areas that need to be where there is a difference that needs to be addressed.
No, and I sent Mr. Martin a reply to his email, and I was very clear that this is not final. This is a draft. This is where staff has come down through consensus on a draft ordinance, but this is going to the Planning Commission and the board, and we will point out the differences for them to decide. And so he knows that.
Good.
Okay.
So hopefully the Planning Commission, when they see column A and then column B, they can come up with their own column C and say, and here's what they recommend to reconcile. Great. Thanks.
Yeah, because you want to focus your energy on only the differences.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Get her done.
Okay. Yeah. Two other quick things. One, I don't know whether the county's aware of it, but the Hilton Hotel this whole week has a huge expo going that's not only in the United States but nationally, that shows equipment that you use for septic tanks, for water resources, for retention of water. I mean, huge, big facility. The whole Hilton Hotel is full of all this specialty equipment that the county uses on a lot of things, like the chiller that Tom's talking about. I mean, they got all this various different equipment. They got providers from all over the country. I talked to several of them down there last night. And I didn't even know what was going on, but I went down there for another get-together. But it's people from everywhere, from foreign countries that's got all their equipment down there, a lot of American companies that are there, construction companies. But I think that if the county has some Keith Henderson and people like that, I think if they got somebody, they ought to send down there and have them take a look at that equipment, the people out of the
like
environmental.
A trade show, huh?
Environmental people, it's all kinds of environmental stuff that are there for taking care of waste management and everything. So I wasn't aware that it
best
was there.
Secret.
So Mark,
yeah.
Hundreds
of people. I mean, you couldn't even hardly
look it up.
You couldn't hardly walk through the aisles. There were so many people from all over the country there flowing into this thing. So anyway, just meant to mention that.
Good.
The last thing I want to say is I want to commend the finance people for their presentation this morning on the third quarter audit. I think they did an absolutely excellent job, and I think it was well put together, and I think that the staff that the county has and their efforts in order to make sure that the public is well informed does an excellent job, and they need a pat on the back or a
attaboy.
Yeah, an attaboy or two, but I think that they did a spectacular job this morning, even though they still have some tweaks to do, but I think it's important.
I agree. They did a great job.
Yeah, so anyway.
First time in many years that we're actually balancing a budget without taking anything from reserves for 2015-16. What a great accomplishment.
I was concerned with creating pockets of money. And so when you start creating a pocket reserve over here, and you don't have it designated for anything, I have a problem with that. So it's like, so what have we been doing for the last 30 years? Well, we balance our budget with the amount of money we have coming in and the bills that we have out there. When things get tough, you tighten up and you do away with the
fluff. smoothing program to smooth out.
But the smoothing program, it depends how you look at it.
Through the good and the bad and the ugly times.
So we collect taxes primarily twice a year.
Yeah.
So you look at the spike, that's when the taxes come in.
Yeah.
Then you have no taxes come in, so you drop all the way down the bottom.
But it's not only that, though,
October,
Tom. It
spikes
taxes.
Back up.
It's not just taxes, though. It's when all these companies hire people at certain times of the year that causes those spikes to go up to Christmas time, holiday time.
Well, that's employment spike.
Yeah.
We're talking about income spike.
I know that.
Yes. So it's just like if I get paid once a month or once a week, I still have to pace myself as to how I spend the money. So I just have a problem with creating a special savings account and then have them come to us and say, you guys are broke. You have no money, and you got to pay these bills. So, well, wait a minute. I got $1 million over here. Why can't I use that? Well, you know, we put that away for a rainy day, and we don't think this is a rainy day.
Yeah.
So they didn't have any definition
to
that.
I talked to Mark Gassway about that afterwards, mm-hmm. and he understands that concern, and I think all of us want to know the visibility of what do we got.
Yep.
If there's a pot of money somewhere, don't just keep it out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
Keep it there when you report on the general fund balance. Show us, include that too. And they get that, and I think that's the intention. So the visibility is going to be presented and proposed to us so that we'll be able to understand there we can't hide it. It needs to be put out there.
The general public is going to say,
your increase in my taxes. Make sure that that happens too.
Your increase in my taxes. And over here in your reserve, you have $21 million in your general fund reserve, and then over here you got another $5 million in another reserve account. What do you mean you're broke and you want to raise my taxes? So that's what you're going to be faced with.
Well, you're broke until you figure out a way to shift the money from one pot to the other pot.
But see, and that's what we did when we balanced our budget. The point is, if we have good times, you don't go out and spend it all. That's when you put it back in your general fund reserve.
I have that's exactly what we're talking about doing.
Right. I have a rainy day fund at home, and I put money aside.
There are various techniques for doing this sort of
thing.
Okay, let's say you're in a private enterprise and you get a Christmas bonus. Okay, put that Christmas bonus in a savings account so that when you have a let's say you're unemployed for a short period of time, you can yank it out to even up your income flow. My wife used to use this technique called a hidden balance in her checking account. There'd be $500 or $1,000 in there that wasn't reflected in the balance, just in case, you know, lunkhead Mark goes in there and writes a check and so it won't bounce.
Yep.
So I think the finance team's objective here is we've got a very good fund balance policy. This is an improvement to it, and it simply takes some of the income stream during good times and makes it available for when the times aren't so good. And it's all in the general fund. We just painted a slightly different color inside the general fund. That's all.
See, I don't understand the purpose.
You could just leave it. You could just run a bigger balance and not call
that's
a reserve.
That's where I'm coming from.
And you accomplish the same thing.
The only thing I can tell you historically, I mean, there certainly have been there, is I think Mark hit it on the head, and that is different people, it's more functional for some than others.
Well, Mark is a good example of dysfunctional.
No, I'm just saying.
Dysfunctional?
Some people survived a long time having separate Christmas savings accounts. In fact, they used to give you coupon books that you saved money separately for Christmas because they had trouble keeping, once it was in their checkbook, that was money that was gone, and if they didn't move it someplace else, it got spent, and the other people are more disciplined, and they can keep it all in one fund. It just depends on how you like to find, you know, do your accounting.
Are we getting Christmas bonuses this
year?
No.
And I, on the same note, I guess, so why just have one fund then? So we're saving for radios, won't we have a reserve fund for the radios? And we're saving for phones, so we can have a reserve fund for the phones. And let's see, we have to replace our fleet, so I guess we better put up.
We actually do have an ER&R replacement fund.
Yeah. We have that within the department on a rotational basis.
The fleet fund, 5091, mm-hmm. collects money from all the departments based on the rental charge for each vehicle. They collect that money and they set it aside so that they can replace the vehicles when they come due.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we collect money from all the departments in the general fund. We give it to facilities and they do all the maintenance and pay all the utility bills. We're simply suggesting that we did this right before the recession in 2007, 2008. Our revenues were very healthy, and I can remember the presentation to the board at the time was, you guys have done a really good job of being restrained in your spending. We look like we're going to have a gigantic surplus, so let's add all these new FTEs. And the board said,
we don't need them, but let's just add them.
And I don't know how many we added, but it was 100 at least. And uh-huh. 12 months later, we're having to issue pink slips to those very same people.
Yep.
And we don't want to be that way.
It would have been so much better had they paid off inherited debt with that extra money and set us up for the future. I think the key word that you're speaking of is two key words. One is you use the word hidden, and in contrast to visible. And certainly the provision, the function to accomplish the stability is what we're all after, but it cannot be hidden. It needs to be very visible.
Yes,
and
no,
that
I would
visible.
I would never suggest that we hide a thing. Here's another, and I don't want to reveal tactics and strategies to all the department directors and electeds because this is being recorded, but I'm going to anyway to make my point. Is if it just rolls to fund balance, then the collective bargaining units, the department directors that report to you, and the electeds are going to go, look at that.
Santa Claus.
That's exactly what they do.
You can't tell me I can't have deputies because I'm seeing it right there. You can afford it. This mechanism, by policy, takes half of that and puts it aside for a specific purpose, which is to smooth out revenues and compensate for bad times.
And you don't think that they'll look at that money and say, well, you still have that money.
We can tell them we have a policy. We're complying with our policy. You can't have it.
And we don't agree with your policy. We think we need deputies.
They're free to disagree with us.
So I've got a Christmas fund over here, and I lose my job. Do I not touch that Christmas fund?
But Tom, it's up to the majority of the commissioners to either approve it or disapprove it. So if it comes along and
we haven't got there yet.
Yeah, I know.
We're mighty close.
they're talking transparency. The more transparency you have, the more the collective bargaining units want that for revenues. Look, you got more than you need. We want some of your profit. That's what they do. They say all big companies. You say it, Ed. I hear you all the time. Look what Walmart's doing. They're making a fortune and they're not paying their employees.
That's right, they are.
See, there you go.
With sales tax, if it was true with property tax, you know, property tax is even keel.
It goes up.
It goes up, but it goes up evenly, and year to year it's fine. Property tax, sales tax does this, and so I mean, what the best thing we could have done in the recession is take a percentage, call it anything over 10%. Is going into a one-time capital fund. And yes, it's our money. Yes, we have it, but we're going to use it to pay down the people's debt or buy computers or telephones or a building, but we're not going to spend it on ongoing expenses like employees. And all the counties got caught up in the same thing. Sales tax revenue was through the roof. We brought on a whole bunch of ongoing expenses with adding employees, and when it fell off, we had to let people go. So it really
tell them how that works in collective bargaining when the union comes up and sees how much money you have.
Well,
but if the board didn't have a policy,
if it's dedicated to one-time expenses,
if we had 100 days of fund balance built up and we didn't have a coherent, well-thought-out policy recommended by a group of professional finance managers,
mm-hmm.
I would agree that the collective bargaining units would make the case that you can afford to give us a 4% raise, and an arbitrator would probably side with them.
Candy.
That's not the case that we're talking about here. We're talking about taking modest amounts of excess sales tax and setting it aside to protect the workforce in the event that we have a bad sales tax year. That's
have we ever used the money that the increase in sales tax to pay for extra deputies? Have we ever used that? We never got a chance to because we just got that and the market crashed and they never got that money. So that money is still set aside for that.
Which money?
No, the 1%.
There's a sales tax.
There was a law enforcement.
For law enforcement. Still out there. You're going to remove that then?
Right? So it has to go to that if we're collecting it.
Yeah, right.
That's what it goes to, I would assume.
Well, I know most of the people working the trades, the electrical trade. Whenever you work overtime, the smart ones take that overtime money and they put it in a separate account in the credit union because they know at some point in time
they're going to go on strike.
Going to come to a workers going to. One thing about the electrical workers, since 1933, they've had a no strike clause. Electrical workers don't go on strike. We have binding arbitration.
Okay.
They put the money aside so they know full well that when Intel shuts down, all these folks out there have been putting their vacation money and their overtime money into separate accounts. So they might be out of work for 6 months or a year. Some of them were out of work for 4 years before Intel got started out there.
You're right. What we want to do here, we're not going to let the employees keep that money. Yeah. We're going to hold it for them for when they don't have that job.
Right.
That's the same difference.
Yeah. And we did that.
No. You gave it to the employees. The employees put it away for a rainy day.
No.
In our
the vacation account and those the
okay, but the employee made that choice.
Well. So it's automatic under the agreement that their 4% Tom goes into the vacation account. It goes into the flex package account. So at the end of the time when the person gets out of work, he can't get the money. He can't get the money unless there's an emergency or unless he's out of work. Then he applies and he gets the money. But just to automatically spend everything, you know, just like these 401s that people set up, that they want everybody to have a 401, anybody go down after you put the money in there for 5 years and you need the money, but you strip it all out of there so when you retire, you don't have any retirement. So
I guess the question is, just to get us moving along here, Mark Gassaway today was simply asking if he could bring a staff report to consent to have the board have a debate and then vote on whether or not this amendment to the policy should be approved.
Amen.
So do we do that or not?
Oh, yeah. So he's going to basically bring something before us. And then we have something tangible to evaluate. Do we want to do this or not? So certainly welcome that proposal.
Yep. You're bringing that to the consent agenda.
Yeah.
You're going to debate that during your hearing time.
Well,
instead of in here, you're not going to debate it here or in a work group. You're going to bring it there first.
Well that's well, it sounds like a good idea to bring it here first.
The legal aspects
of
what we're doing.
Well, you're in a public setting right now.
Yeah.
Whether it's here or whether it's in the hearing room on Tuesday, it's an open public meeting. Right. So you're in compliance with 4230.
I just don't want to use the hearing time for a work session.
Okay.
So in effect, they could approve the amendment to the policy right now.
Well,
that's administrative. It doesn't require a public hearing under 3632. So actually, they could change a policy that is purely administrative on how they want to account for their money in a open public meeting. Yeah.
Well, why don't we do this? As soon as they have it prepared, go ahead and just give us all copies, and we can get it as soon as it's ready, and then if you want to be able to, at that point, Mr. Chairman, decide if you want to be able to have it on consent or if you want to have it here, then we can talk about it. Well, however you want to handle it.
He just said we don't have to have it on a consent agenda. We can make the decision
here.
But one of the things that I want to remind you of, our budget process is huge, and our budget process is brought to us in pieces. Very seldom do we see all the details all at once. A lot of times it'll be a summary of what's there, and that's what we saw today, kind of, was a summary. And then later on, Bob will bring his thing. It's also a summary. It's not detailed. It's a summary. So You're not going to be seeing what you think you're looking at. And one of the things that I don't like is when they come back up and say, well, you know, hey, we're really short of money. We're really down. But yet we've got the money out there for the radios. We've got money out there for the phones. We've got What was the list of things that we had out that we had to buy? And yet we're putting money away, but we're not putting money away to purchase what we have to purchase.
So when they bring that, when we get a copy of what they propose, then at that point you can decide whether or not that's going to be visible enough versus is it going to hide money we don't know about.
I would rather put it out there for something specific. I've got to save money for a new car. I start putting money out there for a new car so I get enough money to buy it. We have to buy new radios and new phones to keep up with the digital world. So we have this Cadillac to drive around like Portland does. That's what we're keeping up with. But that's the truth. But you, to just put it somewhere and say, well, we've got a pot of money here. We don't have anything, any use for it.
Let's
just put it there.
Give them a chance to propose it, and we'll take a look at it when they bring it to us.
Okay.
It's like the Indians building a fire and putting a blanket over to give smoke signals.
Forest code.
Okay, you used up next week's code. Time, too, so next week you don't get any time.
Holy cow. I'm
just kidding.
I asked him first.
Well, he said he didn't have anything.
Okay.
So I'm
easy.
I want to follow up and see if we've got anything with the information on the paint store.
I mentioned that we were doing an appraisal, and last week it would be 3 weeks or so.
Oh, that's right.
And so now it's 2 weeks.
That's better. Yeah, it comes down from 6 months. I remember now.
No, I said 3 months.
Jeez. Okay.
Exaggeration makes the point better.
That's exactly right.
He's got it on the recorder.
But yeah, we do.
Came rushing in at the last minute and had my stuff piled up.
Well done.
Silence.
Well done.
We talked a little bit and got kind of poo-pooed, so I'm glad Chris Horn is here. We were talking about the problems that we've had recently brought to our attention in the auction of properties that we have out here. And we had one case here a while back that we had sold one piece of property 3 different times, and only until the last time when the lady bought it thought she got a good deal and made an improvement on it and went to get a building permit, and she found out that it wasn't buildable. So we were talking about that we would have the responsibility of disclosing just what we know about a piece of property. So a lot of times people look at a piece of property and they see it's 2 acres or 6 acres. They assume they could build a house on that. And not that they got a good deal down here. A lot of times you get a good deal and sometimes you don't. So I think as we do things like that, and we disclose what we know to be true, whether it's buildable or not buildable, whether it's a sliver of land. When Chris Cook was here a week ago, she says, well, that's the responsibility of the buyer. And I felt that since we are the county and we represent the people, that we should at least disclose what we know. And at that time, the question was, well, how much research are we going to do to disclose? And it's like anything else, I guess. If I know there's something wrong with my house and I sell my house, I have to disclose it. If I knew my sewer system was having a problem and I didn't disclose it, and later on the guy that bought it, he could hold me liable for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm asking here in our disclosure of any properties that we auction off out here in the gazebo, that we disclose what we know about that piece of property.
Chris, let me, before you answer that,
okay.
here's what that translates, what it does not translate to.
Here's what Tom said.
Some kind of a guarantee. That's absolutely off the table. That's not what's being asked for. It really has to do with this. The best example is really that one piece of property that was sold 3 times.
The lady.
And each time it was because the previous person found out that it was absolutely unbuildable, and we put it back out, and it happened again, put it back out, and it happened again. It was obvious to us. We're not guaranteeing it, but somehow we're also not revealing the most obvious thing we knew about it that would have been helpful. That's all.
Okay. I like Commissioner Mielke's example of his house, because I think that's actually a good example. It's easy to say that you know that you've got a problem with your septic system, because when you flush it, the backyard gets wet, and that's a pretty easy example. I mean, when that happens, you know you probably got a problem with your septic system, and under state law, you have the absolute obligation to fill out a seller's disclosure statement truthfully. The problem that makes this a little more complicated, and it's magnified by 1800 when you're dealing with Clark County and what do we know, is if the doors don't shut right because your kids, every time they have to shut them, have to slam them, you might not know it, but your kids know it. Are you responsible for what your kids know in your example of selling your house? Or if your wife says that when I run the washer, I can't do two loads in a row because it backs up through the pipe, you may have no idea because she does the laundry and you don't. No, I have no idea, and I'm not being sexist. But that's my point. And the same is true with the county. One department of the county may know one thing. Another department may know another. And trying to figure out what quote unquote we know becomes difficult. I don't have any problem, and it's pretty objective for the county to say when we do this that this property is 2 acres. And the zoning for this property is 5 acres, beware. This lot's too small to comply with zoning. We don't have to go really anywhere but look at a map to know that, and you don't have to trust too much else to be able to answer that kind of question. So there is certainly some information that's very objective that we could put out there in the sense of a warning. And you're right, in the case that the treasurer who conducts these, because he's the independently elected official who's responsible, if they have actual notice and you want to say that to the extent the treasurer knows from prior sales about deficiencies for the property, that he or she has that obligation to include that with the auction, I think that makes sense. But I want to caution you only a little about this, what we know, because it really is a difficult one to satisfy. And once you do it, by the way, you will be held to a standard that you've set for yourself, so people will have a right to rely on that, even though it's not called a guarantee.
So usually by the time we've gotten this far, we know a whole bunch about that property. We probably are aware of liens on that property.
Sure.
And other things, because it's been a period of a year, probably.
3 years.
And so one of the things I remember was Mr. Teeter's. When they
the stormwater?
No, we were going to foreclose on Mr. Teeter's for not being in compliance. And that's how we heard about it at the board. And instead of just foreclosing and taking his property, we went out there and worked something out with him. The other ones that are foreclosed on, we don't hear about it anymore. So I guess if we're going to set policy, I guess we have to do it on our own, because we're not hearing about the other ones. But we're the ones... where the buck stops.
Well, that was one question. Because I've never got a foreclosure complaint since I've been here. So how many of these are we really, you know?
They're exceptions, not the rule.
We probably sell about 20 to 30 properties a year, and you figure over 10 years,
yeah.
I bet we get less than 4%
yeah.
issues. But as I said, asking the treasurer to publish the zoning for the property so that people are on notice that this property doesn't comply with zoning, beware, you may not be able to get a building permit, is probably something that's pretty easy to do. And that'll tip off most people that before they bid on this, they better do their homework.
Yeah. So.
Mr. Chairman, I've said for the last two or three times we've discussed this, I think it's only fair when you say the buck stops at Doug Lasher's office.
No, it stops in this office.
No, I know, but listen to what I have to say. Right now, he's responsible for selling his piece of property. And I think in order to be fair about it, I think that we ought to invite Doug to a work session, have him come up here and explain just exactly what the county's been doing for the last 30 years, because he's been the treasurer for the last 30 years, what they've been doing in order to dispose of these piece of property, and how many complaints they've had, and how many pieces of property that have come back that they've had to sell one time, two times, three times, whatever. Tom, I don't think it's fair for us to strike a judgment of the treasurer's office of maybe not doing his job, basically, because some piece of property's come back, or somebody's complained to me or you or to David about one of these pieces of property that they bought that didn't fall in compliance, and I've got two or three of those emails just like you guys have. But I think that it's only fair that he's the person that the voters have elected him to be responsible in that position. And as the county commissioners, I think it's our responsibility to get him up here and set him down the chair and say, David, Doug, what are you doing? What are you doing and how are you doing this? We'd like to know what your policy is in that. And maybe he's complying with everything that Chris is saying. We don't know that. We're speculating.
That's the reason we make policy.
Yeah.
We are responsible for policy.
Yeah, but we're speculating what he's doing and what he isn't doing. I don't think that's fair.
I know that when it comes back to us, the lawsuits that we're threatened with, in fact, we've got another one. What's the attorney's name? You.
Erickson.
So that's another one. So you may not hear anything about that one, but I hear that one, and you hear about another one. There's a lot of this stuff going on.
Okay.
And so...
Well, I make a motion we get dug up here.
So it appears to me that the policies that we're working with today need to be addressed or fixed.
But you don't know what the policy is until you talk to the person that's in charge of it. Someone, selling the property.
Someone sitting here before you and me made that policy.
Tom, you're not getting what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm saying is Doug Lasher didn't make the policy.
Yeah, but you made the policy. Is he following the policy or isn't he? You don't even know because he hasn't been here to say one way or the other.
Isn't he guided by RCW on disposal of surplus properties? I mean,
yeah, there are minimum standards he has to follow under Title 84.
Okay.
So yeah, certainly.
And can this board compel a separately elected official to follow policy they promulgate?
Well, the board can pass police power regulations. We can't order him to do that. The commissioners cannot pass a law that's inconsistent with state law. That much is easy. In terms of parallel processes or whether or not they can create additional obligations, you'd have to look at that provision of 84 to see if it has a preemption clause, in which case the answer may be no, you can't. But I'll take a look real quick while you're speaking just to see.
And if I can say something. Doug Lasher is following all the law. He's following all the policy. He's doing his job well. There's not a problem there. And that's not what this is about. Instead, what we're looking at is solving a problem that some citizens on an exception basis suffer. Because regardless of the frequency, when somebody puts their life savings into buying a piece of property with the vision of building a home, and then they discover afterwards, we knew but didn't tell them it's not buildable, it's a huge problem.
I understand.
And this is an additional service to provide to our citizens to ensure that we won't get them in that pickle. And the goodwill that we have between this commission and our treasurer is to help us, all three of us, be successful, our treasurer, us, and the citizen. So the idea is, I think what you had actually proposed, Commissioner Melke, was that we do a legal lot determination on those lots that we don't know, that it could be or could not be buildable. Because what will happen if we don't do that is somebody will make the best guess that they're going to buy a lot. They put a lot of money into it, pay extra for it, because they're making the assumption that it is. And the only way right now for them to make that call is to pay, $850 or something like that to a legal lot determination, to get a legal lot determination before they bid on it, and that's just not going to happen. So the idea would be, if there's a big question, is that buildable or is that known not buildable, that we would take that extra step on those lots, or that is the fundamental question, and then add that cost to that lot when it goes to the auction. That way you get the highest price, everybody wins, and they don't get stuck with something that's not buildable.
But if he's already following everything that you said...
He is.
If he is, then what I'm saying, maybe there needs to be a change in the state law.
We don't need state law to do that.
So the county commissioners, yeah.
I think that's what you're looking up, Chris, to see whether or not we can
change the policy.
Oh, okay. So it really has to do with add in an extra policy, if we have the freedom to do so, that this board would say, yes, absolutely, we follow all state law, and we go one step further with our own local policy that says we're going to reveal to the citizens what's most relevant to them when it comes to the purchasing, bidding on these properties.
We don't know that he's not doing that.
I can tell you he's not doing
that. We do know that.
Yeah, I could, in your opinion, that somebody's Lawrence. Come in and told you that. You're taking a citizen's word without even asking the treasurer.
I can verify that. Yeah. But simply, the treasurer puts a disclaimer out there. We're a buyer beware state. It's up to the purchaser to do their due diligence before they buy a property. And much of the information that would tell a prospective buyer that a property is not buildable is already on our GIS information system. You can look up soil types. You can look up floodplains. You can look it all up.
Citizen's not doing his job then, the one that wants to buy the
correct.
Property.
Correct. If there's a disclaimer saying that the county doesn't warrant this property is suitable for any purpose, it's up to the buyer. Now, I'd come around to agreeing with the board that if we know there's a defect and we don't tell prospective buyers about that defect, then we're essentially setting a trap for them, and a trap they can't get out of. And,
we've done that 3 times to one piece of property.
So, again, I think, Tom, it's only fair that you get Doug up here and find out for sure just exactly what he's doing. You don't know.
Well, I don't have a problem with that.
No,
we can invite him up here.
But actually, there's a little history here, and then we have talked with Doug, and he's doing a good job, and it's like his job in this capacity is to be a used car salesman. And he's just simply saying, sold as is, where is, your risk, and that way we're not liable, and just, you know, it's your responsibility to find out what we may already know, that there's sawdust and there's sugar in the gas tank, but we're not telling them. And so we're saying we're going to be go one step further in being more forthright than we are out of our, just simply to avoid the potential risk that we've seen happen multiple times.
So what we're talking about, selling excess property today, and I would think that we would have to do the same thing for that. And examples are up there on 99 and 88th Street. We bought out that old grocery store to do the work we had to do. Now we're going to sell that piece of property because it was cheaper for us to buy it, do our work, and then carve a new property line and sell it. We have the same thing going on 119th Street and 92nd, where we bought the property and the houses and tore them down, and we're going to build our road. Then we come back, we could come back and you say this is a remnant of a piece of property that was used to widen the road, and this is what's left. You have 2.4 acres here, and there was a house there before. I don't know. I can see nothing wrong with that, whether we're selling it or auctioning it. We have to, by law, auction properties that we confiscate. We have to auction those.
You're talking about
right?
properties that,
yeah, that's
like
that's
drug forfeitures?
Yeah, that's different than if we just put a house on the market or a property on the market.
Sure.
But you know,
understand, Doug never becomes the owner. I mean, unlike when we buy property for road widening or for a public purpose, like a park, and we have excess property, we become the owner of those properties, and we have the same obligations any seller has. In a tax foreclosure situation, the county never becomes the owner, nor does the treasurer. We just have a tax lien on that property, and it's not any different than a mechanic's lien that that a couple of carpenters put work money into a house that wasn't paid for that is foreclosed upon to pay their carpenter mechanic's lien or labor lien. And so we sell it. It just happens that the county's tax lien takes priority over all other liens by state law. And he's obligated to sell that for the junior taxing districts, the schools, the ports, all of the people. But and the one thing it probably is really worthwhile for Doug to talk with you, because one of the things you can't lose sight of is very many, and I mean a lot, of the properties that are sold might be slivers.
They
are less than 2,000 square feet, and to do an $800 legal option termination on these nothing pieces of property is a waste of public's money.
I agree. It has to be an intelligent process. It can't be just a, you will do it for all pieces. It would be something that would be, in those properties, that it would be questionable. And just to address your point, we may have, let's say, 10 different buyers down there who each one of them may be interested in two or three different properties. And for them to be able to answer the question about any property, you might have several interested in one piece of property, they would each have to pay hundreds of dollars each before they got there to see, to find out what each one of them really could know up front if we would to present it. Okay. And it makes the property more valuable.
Okay.
Because we disclose at least what we know, what's the most important question to them. We answer it once up front. Everybody wins that way.
Okay, David, let's say property. Let's not say real estate property. Let's say the vans, the trucks, the cars, the other things that the county auctioned off once a year or twice a year that they put up for auction, all this equipment that they have. Are you going to do the same thing for the buyers there? They go, I've watched them at the auction. I've went there several times where the county's auctioned off trucks and stuff. It's buyer beware, the same thing there. So for every piece of property that the county sells now, are we going to go put a thing on there that says to check out the car to see it doesn't have sawdust in it, it doesn't have marbles in the gas tank or whatever else it is? I mean, the county sells all kinds of stuff for surplus, not just property. So how many other parts of this thing you've got to get wrapped up in?
We're talking primarily that little window of property that we sell at an auction.
Yeah, certainly we don't want to expand it into be something that's...
I want to warn the public as much as we can, but again, I say I don't think it's fair that we're having this discussion without the treasurer being here. I mean, that's my personal opinion.
It'd be good to invite him up next week to our board meeting so we could express to him our concern, and we're looking for a solution.
And ahead of that, Chris, you can let us know whether or not we could add one other policy that would assist him with the right tools to inform the potential buyers on properties that are appropriate to even run to ask the question about.
Yeah. Yep. And I know that any of the legal work that we do on a piece of property, whether it be liens, foreclosures, that is all reimbursed to the county, too. So it'd be, if we had to do something else, that would be reimbursed to the county after the sale. So to have an example, Chris, would be that if it's a piece of property that we took for non-payment, your office took the time to serve papers, mail letters, and so on, you get reimbursed. You put a charge on that piece of property,
but those
charges are part of the debt.
Yeah, those charges are all statutorily authorized.
Yes.
So if before you could charge your legal law determination against the buyer, you'd have to make sure that the state law authorized you to do that.
So yeah, and that whatever amount...
So we can look at that.
There's a minimum bid amount.
Yeah, that's the amount of the property tax.
Correct. And then if you can add on to that, we'd have to check into that.
But, so
but certainly if we're reimbursed for the work, that makes doing the work more palatable.
So I want to make sure I understand how it works. Let's say you have a piece of property that sells for $100,000, but they only owe the county $5,000 for property taxes. The $95,000 goes to whoever else... own the property or had the loan on the property, right?
We
only take $5,000 for the
We debt. Only take the amount that's necessary to pay our taxes. Traditionally, what we would do, if you have multiple claims, if there's no other claims, there's only the property owner, we pay it to the property owner because they're entitled to the overage.
Sure.
If there are multiple parties claiming it, traditionally we file what's called an interpleader. You just pay the money into the court and you say, this person and this person and this person all have a claim on it. We don't say who wins. We just put the money in the court. We serve everybody, and then we walk away. And they all fight it out, and the judge makes the decision as to who gets what.
So the attorneys get the money.
So if we add, so if we do add some costs
to
determine, let's say legal law determination or something on a piece of property, then you're really subtracting from the kitty that would go to everybody else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
which is why you gotta check on whether or not we can do that.
That's why, well, that and whether you can do it at all. Because if you, you may just be spending your own money.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
but I would,
good discussion next week.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're gonna let us know the answer to that, Chris?
To both.
Okay.
So the other thing I have on my list is that, to our surprise, our firearms ordinance, when we get looking at it, only has to be tweaked or adjusted because we already allow employees to legally carry with permission of an elected official.
Concealed.
So where we are today, is my understanding, is tweaking that to where we are interested in having the like rules down there that would say we don't want you showing off your new gun here. It's totally concealed, and so on. That's all we're interested in, that they recognize the rules that you have a concealed weapon and you have asked permission to legally carry.
Well, understand that there's two different things that are not at cross purposes, but there are two different issues. One is the county code, and the other is a policy that was adopted and is part of, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's part of the HR policy that requires the county administrator. The policy of the Board of County Commissioners through the HR department is that nobody can carry a firearm without special exception by the county administrator. What you did, or your predecessors did, is they said that for other elected officials, the Superior Court judges and other elected officials, that those persons who wanted to give permission to their employees to carry firearms could do so. So out of respect for the other elected entities, you gave them a certain authority, and your authority has already been exercised through HR, and we've made up a policy saying that for the employees of the Board of County Commissioners, they follow the county's HR policy, and their only right to carry a firearm is through special exception through your county administrator. So while you're elected officials, certainly your policy has been implemented, and that's through your HR policies that you've blessed.
Can I say something?
I have said the verbiage is different than that.
The code and the workplace violence policy say different things. The workplace violence policy, just like Chris said, authorizes the county administrator to approve concealed carry for board of commissioner departments. The other electeds...
For department?
So somebody in Marty's department, somebody in Heath's department.
Okay, I thought you...
The code authorizes the other electeds, Superior Court judges...
Auditor, assessor.
Yeah, auditor, assessor, treasurer, clerk, to approve concealed carry for their employees. So that way every employee of the county is covered one way or another.
Yeah, so I think what you're getting at is that we actually have an inconsistency in our definition, and that's where just simply correcting that definition would solve the problem. Right,
well,
Peter?
And there's a question I have posed to Chris, and maybe we haven't hashed it all out completely, but we're correct in our workplace violence policy. It says an employee can request permission from the county administrator. We have section 902.030 of the county code, which originally dealt with
firearms
and other, and it has a clause in there that allows elected county officials or any person possessing a weapon with the permission of one of them to have a weapon. But years ago, we had a conflict when the state passed the preemption laws, and we adjusted our county code in here, and we separated out the definition of firearms from weapons. So now it appears to me our county code under this exemption doesn't even address firearms. It only addresses weapons.
So there's a simple fix, and you have the simple fix there. All it does is correct the definition, right?
Well, what I propose to Chris to maybe consider is, should we add the exemption for weapons to be placed in the workplace violence policy by adding or elected official, or do we need to go back to our code and add in there and say firearms or weapons with permission of one of them?
Well, the direction I've gotten from the board, just so we could do either one, but what the concern the board expressed was, and this goes back to the discussion you had with Emily, is the board was concerned about opening this up to a level at which we'd have to go open up negotiations with the guild. And we didn't want to have to open up our collective bargaining agreements because we had, the first time this came up, we had a number of the guilds getting ready to complain saying, this is a change in our conditions of employment. We want to have bargaining on this. And so we said, no, we're not going to change it to a point that requires us to open up our collective bargaining agreement. So the question is, how can we make clarifications or minor changes that won't have to require renegotiation with all the guilds how can we make those changes without having to reopen the collective bargaining agreements? And mm-hmm. So what we tried to focus on were, and again, I've been talking with a lot of people about this, but Peter's concern was to have more objective standards so that the exceptions that were provided by the administrator would have guidance and somebody walking in the door would have some sense before he got there or she got there whether they were going to be qualified for an exemption or whether they weren't. And so we tried to write up, recognizing that this is generally fact-specific and somewhat difficult to predict, we tried to write up some guidelines. But we can do, the board certainly has the authority to do just about, in this area, you have a great deal of discretion. But the question for you is, are you willing, if we need to go back to negotiations with the guilds over it? And my last guidance from you is no. If you're willing to do that, we could make it certainly free and clear where employees could just carry weapons, period. But that would clearly require us to renegotiate because we will get requests to bargain. If you don't want to do that, then our only choice is to do this by way of clarification and put some standards in. And we, like I say, I have a couple written that would give some guidance. You might not know you might not think they go far enough, but this has to be written in a manner that is more clarification than a blanket rewrite without mm-hmm. having to go back into rebargaining.
And I think where we are on that, it contradicts. It says, yes, you can, no, you can't.
Well, one regulates weapons, the other regulates firearms, and I think that's what Peter picked up on. You know, our code only regulates weapons, and only the sheriff can allow, only the elected officials can allow them to possess weapons. The fact that weapons used to include firearms was taken out by our office at your request a few years ago. But certainly, on its face, it's inconsistent. The point was, and where I was going with this, which is really what it was written to deal with, was other elected officials have rights. And this policy was written to recognize that you set your policies through HR. That policy said no employee carries a weapon without a special exemption from the county administrator. Other elected officials may have rules for themselves, and they can adopt those, and that respect for those people, the judges, district and superior, and the other elected officials could allow their employees if they chose to, and that's why that was written that way. Now, granted, it's been changed, but that was the original thought behind it.
But, Chris, if that was the intent, either the administrator or elected official, to allow exceptions to carry a firearm in the workplace, and that's in both policies, why would we have to come back to the table and renegotiate it?
Because we removed firearm from the definition of weapon from title from Clark County Code.
So because there was this window of time where it changed?
Well, where the preemption provisions of RCW 941 changed. Okay. So the only language in there is the current policy that the board has. And you have the authority to restrict your fire or your employees. There's a state Supreme Court case that authorizes you to restrict your employees because it's a condition of employment.
So,
but Chris, are we really changing the work environment when the practice is still our county elected officials are still interpreting that code as allowing them to give permission to carry firearms?
First of all, I don't know what they're doing. And second of all, the fact that they're not interpreting it correctly doesn't make an exception. It just means that they're interpreting the law, the code incorrectly. Okay. So I don't want to answer that because I don't know what they're doing.
So in the definition of a weapon...
in our code, there, doesn't include firearms.
A weapon does not include firearms.
Not under our code.
And it says that.
It used to include firearms, but it was amended out.
Oh, okay. So that, but yet it does say in part of it, the judges can authorize different parts of their staff to carry a firearm.
No, it says a weapon.
It says a weapon.
Which right. does not include firearms.
Which does not include firearms.
So how does that affect the prosecuting attorney's office? I mean, I know you have within your contract the ability to carry weapons, but isn't that also, you know, given to the prosecuting attorney for him to grant permission to show up?
Actually, the board has a provision for the prosecutor. The board provided a provision for the prosecutor separately from this. There's separate authority for the prosecutor to carry a weapon.
And any other...
I'm saying a weapon or a pistol?
I don't remember. I'm sorry?
A weapon or a pistol?
I believe a firearm. But let me...
See, and that's where it comes back to, you know, for a long time, these concealed weapons permit, and they changed it to concealed pistol permit. So are we hung up on the definition here?
No, I think...
So we're allowing them to carry a knife?
Yes. That's a weapon, and it's not a firearm.
It's hard to believe that was the intent.
Well, I guess what I want to try and get to is, remember, we can go back and change this. This isn't just a matter of clarification. It's a question of changing how the board does business right now. Right now, the policy for all county employees who are under the authority of the Board of County Commissioners is that they're not allowed to carry a weapon without the permission, without an exception granted by the county administrator. If you want to change that policy in any significant degree, you're going to have to go back to bargaining. If you want to just clarify it, you don't. So you can do it either way you want to.
So why don't we just clarify it?
Sure.
Let me clarify that with the definition of what a weapon is.
In other words, you've got two choices, choice A and choice B.
Right.
One of them clarifies. Why don't we just clarify it and be done?
That's what I want to try and do. The problem is, in the guise of clarification, you can't say, and oh, by the way, that includes anything you want. That's not clarification. That's essentially changing it. What we tried to do is we wrote down some circumstances under which an employee would be qualified to carry a firearm to help explain my use of the term clarify.
Not going there.
Okay.
Peter has two specific choices there to bring clarification. And it doesn't change policy. It just simply, one of them, we can pick the easier one, and both of those are acceptable. Okay. Can't we just pick one of those to solve the problem?
I think if we included firearms in our definition of code that allowed any elected official to authorize his employees to carry a firearm would be a change that would require collective bargaining.
In other words, Peter's choice A and B, both of them end up with that same problem.
Yeah, I think
but
they
only
do.
For those units that are under other elected officials, because the board's policy is clear and unambiguous.
But I think the board, as I listen to them, want to be able to grant those exceptions themselves. Now, I don't know that.
No.
Okay, you don't.
Well,
so
I want my administrator or my risk management person.
So you go to jail.
We don't want to restrict
okay,
other.
So you're only talking about
the only way they could do that, Chris, would be in a public meeting. And they.
Then the answer is I think you probably could.
That blows the concealed part.
Okay.
Well, then everybody knows that John Doe is packing heat.
So if we're only talking
only
about changing this weapon to include firearm for other elected officials, then I think you probably could do that.
Okay, let's go. Ed.
Chris, I need to ask you a question. As somebody that served in the military, and I know Tom did, and I know Mark did.
And I did.
A weapon is anything that you could carry, including 105 howitzer. What
hard to
limit.
Conceal that.
What I'm saying is a Uzi is a weapon that you could carry under your coat. The Secret Service do it all the time. All these weapons that are not a pistol or a handgun, same way with a firearm.
What?
You look at the interpretation of both a weapon and a firearm, that allows a person to... I could come in here with my 300 Winchester shoved down my pants leg. under your interpretation. Well, under your interpretation, and I think that you need to make sure that you're very clear as to what a person can carry. I would say if you say a concealed weapon is a handgun or a knife with a 6-inch blade or a 4-inch blade or something like that, and not a switchblade knife, which is illegal under the law, mm-hmm. you need to specify what they're doing. When you say weapon or firearm, I mean, you're opening it up for everything.
Well, and we can incorporate the definition under state law. As you know, right. Automatic firearms are regulated federally, and you're not allowed to possess
semi-automatic.
I'm just saying automatic weapons are regulated federally.
Right, but semi-automatic
are not.
All I have to do is just take a little fingernail file. It takes me 2 seconds, and that weapon that's semi-automatic that I got to go.
Put you in jail.
Just like that.
All we're asking to do is just simply to make the simple correction to our inconsistent definition.
I'm glad.
And not change anything else.
Okay.
It's already proposed. It's choice A and B. And whatever one you want to pick there is fine.
Okay.
Be done with it.
I'm not sure about the rest of you guys, but we walked around. We called that a weapon. We end up walking around half the day saying this
is my weapon, this is my gun, this is my pursuit, and this is my pot. Hand grenades are a weapon I can carry in my pot.
So Peter, can you shepherd that for me?
All right.
Okay.
We got and you know, quite frankly, I don't think Bill Barron in his 15 years here was ever asked to approve an individual to carry concealed. In my 14 months, I haven't been asked.
That's because it's been unclear.
So,
but what it was, we found out there's a whole bunch of people that didn't ask. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's see what else I might have. I know we've had a lot on our plate. I'd like to get back to this form again so I can don't have to carry all this stuff with me. This one here is more complex. It looks too crowded. But just everything that Ed talked about and everything you talked about and I talked about that we were working on or hadn't come to conclusion. And
that's a worksheet then.
It's a worksheet for us in here. Yeah. And then over here it says what it's related
to. So can you send me a copy?
Yeah. We were hoping you would look at it. That's how we anticipated what you guys are going to ask.
Well, we'll get there, but we have a whole bunch on our plate.
Hasn't Marley been having us update that?
Yes.
I don't think we have. I don't think we've had time to update it, really. So I just wanted to, I didn't want it to die because it had some good merits. And help us stay focused to come to conclusion on things that we talked about. Have you heard anything else from any of the cemetery district asking
for help? Not a word.
Good. That's all I have, I think. Well, that's the same thing. Only go lots.
Speedy
you got a stack.
Nothing other than firearms.
Okay. Axel, you got any?
Not really. Just on a personal note, I'll be out next week going in. Woods.
That's why he's not shaving, because there's some superstition about he saw a big buck, and if he shaves, he won't find the buck again. So
it's real.
I bought the explanation. But it's like, hey, I got a razor in my desk. You want to use it?
You're most adjourned.
Yes. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Great.
I thought you took over there. You was asking Axel. I was just sitting back and waiting to do it.
Commissioner, some time ago, I don't know the exact time frame, I brought in a vacancy request form requesting permission to hire a graphic artist for the PIO office. Many departments in the county like to take advantage of those services. In the absence, we actually have two positions down there, and both are vacant. And so our graphic requirements are going unmet.
Is James no longer here?
Pardon me?
James no longer here?
James quit.
Oh.
Yeah, we had some interdepartmental conflict, and he moved on. So now I have a department director wanting to contract with a private graphic designer. Wants to award four contracts totaling $330,000. I believe the better solution.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Well, that's why I'm talking about it, because this was this was in my consent agenda file for next Tuesday, and I think that the best solution would be for the board to authorize the PIO to hire a graphic artist to have on staff full time to meet the varied demands that the county has for those kinds of services, rather than going to the outside world.
So, what does a graphic artist is one that does graphics on the computer?
Yes, they use sophisticated graphic software to produce products that the directors use to prepare information materials for the public. They design things for the internet site, and
so is that the job there?
No.
The job description?
No, I
add for the board.
Pardon me?
Can I add in for the board budget presentations?
Oh yeah, for documents that we prepare for the public, the any graphics we use for the state of the county.
You use it during GMA.
Yeah, and Oliver's makes tremendous use of the graphic artist for his materials. I don't have the job description with me, but I would ask the board for permission to proceed with the recruitment action, and I'll get you the job description. But it's something that you know, we do a lot of fine work around here, and it, you know, pleasing, effective graphics tell the story very, very effectively, and I think I could bring in a parade of department directors and elected officials that would ask you to say yes.
When Mark brought this up about 2.5 months ago, when I first come here, I collected a whole bunch of graphics that was done by the county, beautiful work that the county had done within in house here. And I think that it's important that we
don't pay to have things done halfway.
Right. I think it's important that we continue to do that.
Now, two things. One, do we have the budget for it?
The positions are established. The budget's
okay.
There.
And the second thing is it.
And it's factored into the balanced budget that Bob reported.
That's the right answer. Okay. The other is it takes time to go through the process of recruiting and finally bringing somebody on board. And if there be something that's pressing.
We already have a contract with one of these people.
So we're not putting our current staff in a hardship position because we're waiting for an employee.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, great. I'm good with it. Supportive.
Oh, you support what?
The idea of allowing the graphic artist to join our staff, opening that position.
Oh, I thought he was authorizing the contract.
No.
Cheaper to have a staff member do it.
Yeah. But I still would like to, as we go down this road in that process, see the job description.
Yes, I'll get it for you.
You're going to be a vacancy request?
And scale?
Yes.
Great.
Okay. I'll get that for you.
Okay.
Now, I want to make sure that our scale for a graphics person is in line with the private sector.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, it's actually lower, but I'll get it for you. Okay, second thing is... I'm behind on my professional education for my CPA. You authorized me to go to a conference in Yakima. I really appreciate that. I got 16 credits for that. One of the requirements that I have to meet by December 31st is a 4-hour ethics course. John Payne he gave me this. There's a course at the Heathman Lodge on the 18th of November.
Great.
I would like the board's permission to be absent from my workplace to attend this training. It so happens on the 18th we have a number of hearings.
Panhandling
and that sort of thing. Typically,
we have a panhandler for that.
He'll be clean shaven for that. You know, the staff comes up and makes the presentations for the hearings, and I just would like your permission to be absent that morning.
I don't know. Is that ethical?
I think it is.
Or ethics class.
Are you going to want to raise your money once you get a CPA certification?
I'm just maintaining. I'm not augmenting or enhancing.
I want to make sure.
Yeah, I'm certainly good with that, Mark.
Okay, I appreciate it. Very
nice. Yeah. So we got consensus,
so
yes.
Since you brought up Axel and panhandling, has that been implemented?
No, we have a hearing coming up.
The hearing is on the 18th to adopt. That's the same day we also have the transportation program plans and a number
day.
Of other things. But this should be
fun. No, I need ethics.
Okay. We're good?
I'm done. You guys?
Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
How much is your class?
Sorry?
How much is your class?
I don't know.
If anybody is interested, we're adjourned.
Oh, yeah, we are. Press the stop key.